Ganley, this is NHPR News. It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New research out of Dartmouth adds to the already long list of studies on how violent video games affect children. The Dartmouth team finds that teenagers who frequently play what it calls risk-glorifying video games are more likely to engage in risky behaviors themselves, like drinking, smoking, and unprotected sex. As the study's lead author puts it, your moral compass is warped as a consequence of practicing being a deviant character in these games. But there's plenty of pushback to this idea. Those who say this view is oversimplified, that other factors are far more indicative of how kids turn out, and that long-term tracking surveys show today's teens are actually better behaved than their parents were. This hour on The Exchange, we dig into these questions, and later, an update on the ongoing Market Basket saga. But as we start out with video game content and the impact on young brains and emotions, let's hear from you. How do you think violent gaming affects young people? A little, a lot, or not at all? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests for the hour. With us is Jay Hull, chair of the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Dartmouth College, lead author of the study I mentioned, linking risky behaviors with video games. And Jay Hull, it's great to have you. Thanks for your time.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you, Laura.
Also joining us, Cheryl Olson, co-founder of the Center for Mental Health and Media at Massachusetts General Hospital, Harvard Medical School. Cheryl's the author of Grand Theft Childhood, The Surprising Truth About Violent Video Games and What Parents Can Do. And Cheryl, great to have you too. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
Well, both of you, but I'll turn to you first, I think, Cheryl. Why is it so difficult to reach consensus on this idea, on this question of violent video games and whether or not they encourage real-life violence, real-life behavior, bad behavior? You know, some studies say yes, some studies say no. A lot of people say we just don't know.
That's a huge question. I'll try. In a nutshell, one of the problems is we don't know what we're talking about when we say violence or violent video games. Different people have completely different ideas, and some people will say, all aggression equals violence, and some people say, well, aggression is what, you know, football players have and so on, and violence is when you knife somebody or shoot them. So that's one issue. Different parents can look at different video games and say, well, those are just, you know, aliens blowing up. That's like my, you know, the cartoons I watched as a kid. And other people say, well, any kind of violence in these games is wrong, and I don't want my kids exposed to it.
So we don't have a consensus definition of what we mean by violence in video games, Cheryl.
Right, that's one of the first problems.
Okay, and what's another problem, Cheryl? Why is it so hard to reach agreement on this question?
Another thing is some of the behaviors we're talking about. Like the research I did when I was on the faculty at Harvard had to do with naughty behaviors like, you know, school problems, getting into fights, and so on. Those are normal behaviors for middle school kids. Most of them engage in that at least once in a while, even if you don't like it. So that's, and among boys especially, it's normal to, you know, jockey around to see kind of who's on the top of the totem pole. That might be a little, involve a little bit of pushing and shoving, might involve verbal interactions. So that's another issue. And a lot of the studies we're looking at involve lab measures of aggression that, and sometimes a fraction of a second difference between a violent and nonviolent game playing on the behavior. And it depends on what other variables you bring in and control for. So there's just so many ways to slice it that it can make your brain spin.
What do you think, Jay Hull? Why is there so much conflicting opinion on this question?
I agree with everything that Cheryl just said. I think that, you know, there's a variety of different ways to define what you're measuring as aggression. There are a variety of different ways to define what exactly is violent in the game. And there's the problem with any kind of design, any kind of research, where you can't experimentally manipulate things and look at the outcome that you're particularly interested in, because it just would be unethical. So, for example, it would be unethical. It wouldn't get through any review boards to say, well, we're going to have these kids play violent games and these kids not play violent games, and then we're going to watch and see what happens as a consequence of that. Do they beat each other up on the playground? So you're stuck when you're testing these kinds of ideas with essentially weaker kinds of research designs. Well,
so
without getting into a lot of details, that doesn't really allow a kind of causal hypothesis the way that a lot of other kind of science does.
Well, tell us, Jay, how you folks at Dartmouth tried to get at this. Okay, so I hear you on the constraints about conducting this research in the first place, but you guys tried to be definitive, right? Go ahead.
I'd balk at the word definitive. In fact, in your setup for the kind of pushback that people have on these kind of topics, I agreed with a lot of the kinds of things that you said. So just to go through, I'm not going to get into the weeds with respect to the particular kinds of designs that we use, but I think most people are familiar with the idea that, two things, because they're associated, doesn't mean that one causes the other. So there are, studies that go out and measure the correlation between these kinds of gameplay and things like bullying, and Cheryl's done a very nice job of that and done a pretty in-depth job of looking at how kids react to these games and that it does correlate with some of these other kinds of measures, like bullying or fighting. What we tried to do is then take that further and look at it longitudinally, so over time. So we differ from other kinds of studies in a couple respects. One, we have a very large sample. I mean, we started with 5,000 kids, and then we followed them for a very long time. We followed them for 4 years. So we got them when they were about 13 years old, almost 14, and then we followed them until they were almost 18. And we were able to then track a variety of behaviors over time. And that kind of longitudinal design helps you to answer certain kinds of questions and tease apart whether, for example, gameplay is predicting subsequent aggression or is prior aggression predicting subsequent gameplay. We looked at, does gameplay predict subsequent aggression? And not only subsequent aggression, but increases in aggression over time. But the main thing, the main contribution of the paper that we did was that we don't focus exclusively on aggression. In fact, we're not particularly interested in aggression. We're interested in, as you set up, a kind of broader range of deviant behaviors. We're particularly interested in health risk behaviors. So, for example, as you mentioned, drinking, smoking, risky sex. In a previous study, we looked at reckless driving. We did look at aggression. We did look at delinquent behaviors, but we're trying to make the broader point that playing these games, and in particular certain kinds of games, that's important to keep in mind too, have the person, the player, identify with a person who's doing deviant, antisocial, non-normative things. And as a consequence, like you mentioned my moral compass quote, I'm not sure how comfortable I am with the quote, but it does capture what we're trying to talk about. People's sense of right and wrong is, in a sense, affected by acting as a bad character in these games. And so another complexity in looking at the literature is a lot of times they don't make distinctions between the kinds of games that are being played and the kinds of characters that you're playing in those games. And Cheryl points this out in her book, and again, it's Grand Theft Childhood, and it goes through a lot of the details of, the complexity of this issue with respect to aggression. It's quite different if you're playing, I think, it's quite different if you're playing, an American soldier fighting Nazis versus a Nazi killing unarmed civilians. It's who you are in these games and not simply what you're doing. And I think that point is missed by a lot of the researchers who are looking at this question. Yes.
That's really interesting. So let me make sure I have you right, Jay. So it's not so much the level of violence, but the goals behind that violence.
That's the way that we look at it, because you can't really explain why these kids are more likely to get involved in a variety of deviant behaviors like drinking and smoking, because they're not drinking in these games. They're not smoking in the games. They're not, until recently, engaged in risky sex in the games. They are reckless driving, and they're behaving violently. And the kind of classic interpretation of that is that you're practicing things in the game, which then carry over to real life. You're practicing being aggressive, and that carries over into real-life aggression. But we say, look, they're not practicing the kind of general deviance, the specific things of drinking or smoking in these games. They're practicing being a bad person.
Overall.
And the particular games that we have in our study are things like Grand Theft Auto, where you're playing an underworld thug working their way up the criminal hierarchy, or Manhunt, where you're basically being directed by a psychotic director to kill people in creative ways. Now, admittedly, there's another question in there that asks about mature-rated games generally, but that's why I think one of the ways that we characterize the game is it's kind of like Breaking Bad. It's like you are practicing being bad.
Sure, let me get you into this, too. And I also want to remind our listeners that you can join us in just a moment. We'll start taking your questions and comments. The number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. As we look at this question about the impact of violent video games on young people, what do you think? Do violent games affect young people a lot, a little, not at all? Love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Cheryl, what about this idea that violent video games, okay, not necessarily makes kids go out and, you know, steal cars or kill people, but that it gives them practice being bad, to put it simply?
So interesting. There were some parents in the research that I did. We did surveys and focus groups, and some parents were concerned if my child is playing a thug in a game, are they training to be a thug? And we were in the next room doing focus groups with their 13-year-old sons, and one of the things that came up over and over is these kids said the violent games like Grand Theft Auto are fun because of the unreality of the games, things that they said, you know, hopefully will never happen to you, and that's why they could play with the idea of being these characters. And when you talk to child development experts, they talk about kids needing to try on different identities and see who they are. You know, my background is in public health, and one of the things we worry about is kids, you know, getting drunk so that they can sort of, you know, try on acting different ways and then say, oh, I was drunk, that wasn't me, I didn't mean that, and not get in trouble with their friends. And to some extent, you could say maybe they're trying these personalities on in games. Sometimes they're being someone of a different gender, a person with a special skill. Yeah, so you can look at it that way, too, and say, well, this isn't something where they see it as practice. They see it as, who am I in the world? And there may be a small percentage who are, you know, excited and glorifying the violence. The kids I worry about are the ones who are doing this all the time and not involved with other kinds of activities, and maybe doing it with a group of, you know, deviant peers, playing as a group a lot and reinforcing each other. And that's really hard to study.
So a lot. Partly it's quantity, not quality, quantity.
And other activities. Is this all the child is the kid focusing on violent games where they're, you know, maybe where they're playing a deviant kind of person almost to the exclusion of other activities in their lives?
All right.
Balance is a huge thing.
Lots of people want to jump in our conversation. We'll go to you after a short break. More on the effect of violent video games on kids. Why it's so hard to come to consensus on this question. 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR.org is your source for New Hampshire news and policies. Click over right now to catch up on our in-depth coverage of the 2014 primaries and midterm election. Follow the latest on the campaign trail every day at NHPR.org. Partly sunny for most of the state today. North Country has a chance of afternoon showers. Highs today, upper 60s to lower 70s. Partly cloudy most of the state tonight. Mostly cloudy, chance of showers in northern Coos County. Lows tonight, upper 40s to mid 50s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Squam River Landing, a thoughtfully planned community of single-family homes overlooking Squam Lake, designed and built by Sipikin Partners, squamlanding.com. And the Keene Sentinel, serving the Monadnock region with local daily news coverage and innovative advertising solutions. Information and subscription sign up at sentinelsource.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking once again at the question of violent video games and what effect they may have on our kids. Are they encouraging violent behavior or other kinds of risky behavior? Let us know what you think. 1-800-892-6477 is our number here in The Exchange. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. It's NHPR Exchange. All one word. We have two guests. Jay Hull is with us, chair of the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Dartmouth College, lead author of a new study linking risky behaviors in video games. Also, Cheryl Olson, co-founder of the Center for Mental Health and Media at Massachusetts General Hospital, Harvard Medical School, author of Grand Theft Childhood, The Surprising Truth About Violent Video Games and What Parents Can Do. One more time, that exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. And Jay and Cheryl, I'd love to go to our listeners now. And Anne is in Wyndham. Hi, Anne. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I was so happy to hear right before you went to break, Ms. Olson made the mention that the exclusion of other activities is a big part of the concern. I hate to paint anything with a wide brush, and my boys play GTA and Call of Duty, but I'm extremely involved in their lives. We have conversations. They play sports. They're student leaders, and I just think you cannot say that a violent game makes a violent child. A parent's responsibility and how they monitor this and have open discussions is crucial. And that, I think, needs to be examined as well.
And so when you peek over their shoulders and you see them, you know, playing a game where they're, you know, killing other people, running other people over with cars, how do you feel? What's your gut reaction?
Well, my gut reaction is I used to, you know, play with the kids in my neighborhood, you know, cops and robbers. And there was always someone that was shot with our pretend gun. It is certainly not the same level of violence. But this is also a social interaction. And as much as, you know, we can't close the barn door, this generation is dialed in. And if part of their social activity is being able to talk with their friends online, you know, I think that that's part of it. Am I thrilled? No, I wish that they'd only play NHL. But I think that if they're going to do it, they need to do it with an open forum with me and to have the understanding of what I think is acceptable behavior. And I mean, recently GTA, it's been found out that people can modify it to violate other avatars. That's a conversation we had and what my expectations are if that were to happen and to them. And I think that we're not discussing enough about there are good kids playing these games, good kids who are strong role models who just happen to play these games. And it's how they're raised and what else is going on in their lives.
GTA is Grand Theft Auto. And I had heard, Anne, too, what you said. And I'll turn to you first, Jay Hall, that Grand Theft Auto recently read that you can do versions of it where you can actually rape someone in the game, which some of us were a little taken aback by. But go ahead, Jay, your thoughts on her broader point that, look, it's play. The kids get it. They are, you know, they've got other things going on in their lives and that it's not, you know, it's not harming them. Her kids are good kids.
So all I know is the data that we've looked at and how I've tried to address that question, because it isn't, I mean, it's a very logical question. And it's one as a parent of two kids who are now through their teens and into their 20s and 30s, I would wrestle with myself. So, and I think that it's a good point. It's important that, and I imagine that Cheryl will agree, that parents certainly know the kinds of games their kids are playing and sit down and talk to them about the roles that they're playing in the game and provide that kind of supervision on the kind of values that are being endorsed in the game. And that's one of the points that we try to make. But the way that we try to look at it in the data was to say, well, we have measures of parental warmth and sensitivity and the extent to which the parent is involved in the child's life, the extent to which the parent knows what the kid is doing, who they're hanging out with, whether they're doing their homework. And we took a look at those measures and we tried to statistically control for them. And those measures didn't really knock down the effect. We still saw the video game effect. So
you
I looked
still
at
saw
it differently.
A link. Yeah.
So I looked at it differently. I said, well, among those kinds of parents, are these games less predictive of these kinds of bad outcomes? And the answer was no. And then I took a look at, well, among parents who the kid says, my parents never let me play those games, do they show a different effect? Because some of them do go out, and then they say, I play Grand Theft Auto. My parents never let me play these games, but I play Grand Theft Auto. Is Grand Theft Auto associated with a smaller effect among those kids? A little bit, but not much. And just to bring it back to, you know, I'm not focusing on aggression. I'm talking, let's take one of our measures, which is binge drinking, which I think every parent would be concerned about. These games, the particular ones that we looked at, not all video games. In fact, generally video games are associated with less of those kinds of bad behaviors. It's the mature-rated risk-glorifying games that we look at that are associated with increases in things like binge drinking. And different from the aggression kinds of measures that you get, binge drinking is a very specific kind of measure that shows big effects. We're not talking little effects. So, for example, among the kids who are playing Grand Theft Auto, among the kids who aren't playing Grand Theft Auto, they're saying, no, I don't play that game. And you ask them, have you ever binge drunk more than five drinks on an occasion? You get a quarter of them saying that they have. So among the kids who don't play Grand Theft Auto, you get a quarter. Among the kids who have played it, you get 60%. And we see that kind of effect repeatedly with all of these measures, not just have you ever binge drunk, but have you binge drunk in the last 30 days? How much alcohol do you drink? Do you smoke? You regularly get those kind of 2 to 3 times the risk-taking behavior among the kids who are playing these kinds of violent games of Grand Theft Auto or Manhunt or mature-rated games generally. They are more at risk for doing that. And even if you take the kids who say, I've never done that in the past, and then you follow them up for the next measurement period, have you done it in the past 8 months? These games are associated with double and triple the likelihood of engaging in those kinds of actions.
Even in those families where you controlled for things like, as our caller says, they have other activities, they have lots of friends, they get out of the house, we have a close connection with them.
Yeah, let me give you the controls that we have on some of these things, and they just don't knock down the video game effect very much. Age, gender, the education level of parents, the income of the parents, their parental responsiveness, demandingness, the race, church attendance, R-rated movies, self-regulation of the kids, self-esteem of the kids, television watching. We control for all of those things statistically. And again, there is a weakness to trying to engage in statistical controls. All I can say is, you know, not to make a pun, but these data are relatively bulletproof against pretty much any kind of controls, covariates that you can throw in there to knock them down.
Let's take another call if we could, Ann. Thanks for that one. Kevin's in Goffstown. Hi, Kevin. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I joined the conversation recently. I don't know if this had already been mentioned. I seem to remember hearing that the military will use simulations or essentially video games to kind of desensitize the soldiers to the effects of violence. And I have played these types of games before, but I happen to believe that if you start getting involved in these games, you want to keep going until you beat the game, and then the next franchise comes out and keep going. So I don't necessarily agree that you can, I guess, get involved in the games but not feel the effects of them. I definitely think that these games desensitize or at least dull the senses of those who play them, and definitely contribute to some of the violent behaviors that we're seeing. And I am totally against that.
Well, Kevin, thank you for calling. And I know you've looked at this question, Cheryl Olson, whether violent video games desensitize young people to real violence, to having empathy for people who are, you know, hurt or in trouble.
Sure. That's something a lot of parents express concern to us about. I actually got a book on next to me in my office by coincidence called War Play, Video Games, the Future of Armed Conflict, where someone just looked at the issue of the Army and military training. And my understanding of what the military does, first of all, is that they don't use games to desensitize people or teach them to shoot or anything. They use games to teach people how to work together as a team. A lot like the kids who are playing Call of Duty online with their friends are learning how to work together as a team. Also, I have kids say to me in focus groups, you know, well, what if you see a movie where someone gets their arm ripped off? The first time you might be really upset, but what about the 20th time? So even the kids were concerned about this. But I talked to a lot of my colleagues at Harvard who are child psychiatrists, and they said, what we see with kids, if it's one thing about to be desensitized to violence in media. It's another thing to be desensitized in real life. These kids, if they see a friend get hit by a car or injured playing soccer, they're just as upset no matter whether they play these games or not. The kids who are desensitized are the ones who see violence in real life, you know, in the home and so on. And the other thing I want to just say briefly about the concern about linking, you know, Grand Theft Auto, say, with binge drinking. I found in my research the kids who played violent games, that was linked to playing with older people, older siblings and so on. And it may be that some of those kids are, you know, if you're playing a game like that that's designed for an older person, that's because they're hanging out with older kids. And that's also why they're getting more involved in these precocious, risky behaviors. That's just one way of interpreting this. There's lots of ways.
Well, and you mentioned teamwork, Cheryl. Here's an email from Rebecca who says, I'm a parent who's very much opposed to the idea of violent video games. However, Rebecca says, I see a lot of social benefits, such as teamwork and the social spaces of games, as being really great for my 11 and 13-year-old boys. They are more interested in games like Halo or Minecraft, in which they can work together with other kids to solve problems. Can I ask your guests to weigh in on the social benefits or of teamwork building upside of video games, even if they are violent? Now, Jay Hall, I know you didn't specifically look at this question, but I wonder what your thoughts are anyway.
I think that that is exactly right. Again, what we're trying to emphasize is it matters what you're doing in the game as far as how you think about it. You know, if you're a team leader in Medal of Honor storming the beaches at Normandy, that is qualitatively different than if you're playing somebody who's shooting cops. You know, I play these games. I play the most recent version of Grand Theft Auto. Within the first couple frames, you're robbing a bank, and the only way to get past the guard is to shoot him in the head. And once you've shot him in the head and you can get your compatriot out, you start spraying police cars with bullets. It matters what you're doing and how you're thinking about it. Certainly there's evidence that, in fact, video games can cultivate good habits in problem solving, as your guest pointed out. I mean, you're thinking your way through these kinds of problems. If you're playing like Myst, I used to play that when I was a kid, or even, you know, I played the Tomb Raider games, the Lara Croft games. They're puzzle solving. And I think that that's important and a good thing that these games can do. But if you're basically exemplifying bad values, I think that can basically dull your sense of right and wrong. So it matters a lot what exactly you're doing in the game and how you think about that. To go back briefly to Cheryl's point with respect to hanging out with other kids, we, and I don't have time to go into the complexity of the models that we looked at, but we looked at a variety of things that the gameplay could have led to, which then subsequently led to these bad behaviors, and found that, in fact, playing these kinds of games increases general sensation-seeking, thrill-seeking. It increases general rebelliousness. It increases, for example, with drinking, hanging out with other kids who drink, thinking that other kids who drink are cool, thinking that if I drink, good things will happen to me. Taking into account all of those is one of the ways in which the games increase the tendency to essentially accept deviance. And it's that tolerance of deviance that we think then leads to subsequent deviant behavior. Nevertheless, even taking all that into account, we still see a direct effect of the game that's not simply explained by those factors. So,
all right, let's take one more call if we could. Thanks, Rebecca, for the email. And Tat's calling in Concord. Hi, Tat. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Yeah, so I was just wondering if you guys had ever taken into consideration other types of role play where people can experience deviant behavior. What I'm thinking of in particular is Dungeons & Dragons. I remember when I was a lot younger, we used to do that for, you know, 6 to 8 hours at a time. And if I could get your opinion on experiencing deviant behavior like that.
That's really interesting, Tat. Yeah, so Dungeons & Dragons, just to let people know, and a lot of people know what this is, but correct me if I'm wrong, Tat, you play with a book and you make these scenarios and, you know, the characters do pretty, you know, they do pretty horrible things. I stab you, you jump on me. I mean, it's not a tea party.
Exactly.
But it's not video, Cheryl, and I wonder what you think. I've had kids at my house playing Dungeons & Dragons, and they're making up the stories or they're reading them from a book, but the stories are, you know, some of them are pretty horrifying.
Right. So, one of the difficulties with the research is if we're asking people, I did this in print surveys and in focus groups, and Jay's groups did with phone surveys. If you're asking people, have you ever done this? Have you done this once? And so on. You can't possibly capture the complexity of how much time are you spending? What are you doing with that time? Do you view this as real? What are their interactions with your friends? And that's one reason that some of this research is so hard to know, for parents to know what to do with. But yeah, I mean, my son has been involved with, you know, rogue trader or role play games and other kinds of things. And a lot of it really has to do with the social context and what the kids think are happening with it.
So is it better or worse if it's on a video screen, Cheryl, or does it make a difference?
There was a Supreme Court case a few years back that some people might have heard about where Arnold Schwarzenegger, of all people, signed violent games and movies. He signed a law in California trying to require new warning labels on ultra-violent, quote-unquote, video games. And the Supreme Court, after, you know, long story short, ruled that the researchers hadn't made their case that video games were somehow worse than other types of media. I think some parents worry about, well, if they're acting it out in the game as opposed to just watching it, is that worse somehow? And, you know, is it worse if they had a controller that looked like a gun or something? And most controllers don't look anything like a steering wheel or a gun or so on. But, you know, but you could argue just as easily that, well, if you're playing a game, you know it's a game. You can stop at any time if you're upset, where if it's a movie, all you can do is watch it. The same thing will happen over and over, and you can't change it, and you're just ingraining that vision in your mind. This is a very controversial and tough area, but so far I don't think we have the evidence that the playing it with the visuals is necessarily worse. In the future, we might have other research that says different.
Well, and speaking of future research, both of you, Jay, you first. So what more do we need to know on this topic? I mean, it's been studied a lot, and you've got your new study, Jay. And by the way, we've got that on our website if people want to take a closer look at it. But what more needs to be looked at with this subject?
A variety of things. Before I answer that, let me get back to Cheryl's point about movies. So we have in our data, this is not in the publication that we have, but we have R-rated movie measures, and we also have measures of the kids reporting the movies that they've seen, and we've had those movies coded for the amount of aggression, minutes of aggression in the movies themselves, a judgment of the aggressiveness of the movie and violence in the movie made by an external observer. And what we can see by including those simultaneously with the video game predictors is that they're separate issues. And in fact, the exposure to movies predicts the outcomes that we're looking at. And again, we're not simply focused on violence. In fact, it's the smallest part and some of the weakest effects that we have in our data. We're focused on general deviance. The movies are predictive of that with respect to aggression. Video games are as well. And the video game effect is generally larger than the movie exposure effect. So to go back to your viewer's question, you know, we end our paper by quoting Kurt Vonnegut, who says, you should be careful who you pretend to be, because in the end, you are who you pretend to be. That's the kind of idea that we're getting at, that trying on these different roles, as Cheryl mentioned, can actually leak over into everyday life to change your sense of who you are. Because basically, I'm a researcher who looks at self and identity. I'm not a video game researcher. We just looked at this as a vehicle for testing our hypotheses about how identity and self can affect ultimate risk behaviors. And I've been looking at those questions for 30 years, drinking and smoking.
A lot more questions. And Cheryl, I'm sorry to ask you to keep it short, but I will. I do want to hear from you, though. What else needs to be looked at with this subject, Cheryl, in your opinion?
What we need to do is get more studies of real kids in real situations. When we reduce all this to, you know, quick questions, exposures, and statistics, we miss out. What are kids doing in their actual homes and with their friends, and how do they see what they're doing? I think that the parents who say, I sit down with my kids and I watch them play and I see how they react to it, they've got exactly the right idea. That's what parents should be doing, is, you know, find out from your child, how do they react? Does this upset them or scare them? Are they able to let it go? Parents need to be involved and see what's happening, and that's the only way you'll know how it affects your particular child, because they may be just trying this role on as part of fun with their friends, or they might see it as something more serious.
Okay.
But Cheryl,
I got to let you go. I do apologize. Both of you, thank you so much. Love to talk to you again on this subject. Thanks for being with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, America's changing relationship with cars. Then a new book about a fateful U.S. naval expedition to the North Pole. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. New Hampshire weather for today, partly sunny across most of the state. North Country has a chance of afternoon showers. Highs today from upper 60s to lower 70s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from R.H. Irving Home Builders, whose net zero energy homes, solar PV systems, can supply all of your new home's heat, hot water, AC, and electrical needs. RHIrvingHomeBuilders.com. And from Pure Waters of New England, offering a full line of office coffee services for small businesses looking for an efficient and environmentally friendly alternative to K-Cups. PureWatersNE.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Now on The Exchange, we turn to the story that's dominated New England headlines for weeks, Market Basket. And with another look at this saga are Mike Cody. He's with me in studio. He's business and city editor at the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Mike, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks, Laura.
And with us on the line from Massachusetts is Kurt Nickisch. He's WBUR's business and technology reporter. He's been following this story as well. And Kurt, great to have you too. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Well, and Kurt, I'm going to turn to you first. What's the latest that you're hearing about this story? Any news from headquarters in Tewksbury, Massachusetts, or out of Governor Patrick's office?
Yeah, well, the big story yet this week is just whether or not workers are going to go back to work on Friday like the company told them to do. Of course, there have been repeated warnings to do so before, but this time the company says it's a final warning. And these are really the folks who have disrupted and paralyzed the company. This is the few hundred warehouse, distribution, and headquarters workers who walked off the job and basically kept food from getting to all the stores. So the governor yesterday here in Massachusetts, Deval Patrick, spoke. He had put out a statement early in the week or last week, urging the two sides to sort of move on and offering his help, but realizing, you know, it's a private company and he didn't want to sort of get mixed in. Well, Arthur Titomoulis, the fired CEO, and the chairman of the board both reached out to him. And so the governor gave a little bit of insight into the negotiations. He says that the two sides are close to a price to sell the company to Arthur Titomoulis, and indicated that the other terms, such as financing, are sort of where the two sides differ. And then the governor took an extra step and sort of urged workers to go back to work and stabilize the company while the deal is finalized. And, of course, that's what the board has been asking workers to do. But workers have not wanted to do that. They wanted to keep the pressure up for the board for shareholders to sell the company to Arthur Titomoulis. And so they say still that they're not going to return to work until Arthur T is back.
So, Kurt, two headlines then as of today. One is on Tuesday, the company said to workers, get back to work by Friday or else. The other headline is Deval Patrick getting involved and saying, hey, there's a deal in the offing, and we could have a breakthrough on this soon.
Yeah, we could. But the interesting thing is that after the governor made his statements yesterday, the board came out and said, yes, the governor's right. People need to get back to work so we can start putting people back to work and serving customers and making money again. And then and workers said, no, we're not going to do so. And so you really, in a way, as far as the negotiations go or the standoff goes, it was both sides sort of drawing their lines in the sand a little bit deeper. So I wouldn't be surprised for this to continue. It doesn't. We're not seeing movement, I guess, is the way to put it.
Yeah, Mike Cody, bringing you into this. How has this affected New Hampshire? It's gone on for a long time now, so it seems like every day there's yet another ripple effect.
Before I came in here, I was playing Grand Theft Market Basket. I just downloaded it on my phone today. I thought it was going to be a violent game, but it's not violent, so parents, your kids can play it. It's more like a game of Monopoly that never ends. And in New Hampshire, it's been, we have 8,000-9,000 part-time workers plus all the store managers. Although this story is, coming out of Massachusetts with Market Basket's headquarters there, it's probably even a bigger impact economically in New Hampshire, because we're a much smaller state. We have some towns where Market Basket is the only player, and we face all these people who might lose their jobs. And we just went through this a year or so back when Stop and Shop and Shaw's pulled out, a much smaller number of people. But we had hundreds of workers who were displaced, and those stores probably wish they were still here.
Yeah. So, and talking about repercussions, I've been thinking about some of the plazas around New Hampshire where Market Basket is the anchor. I mean, there's other little stores like little card shops and so forth. And I'm wondering, Mike, if anybody's even going to those shops anymore. What are you hearing from people who sort of are located in these plazas where the Market Basket is now basically, well, for all intents and purposes, not open? I mean, it's open, but nobody's shopping there.
Well, the one that we took a look at this weekend because we thought it was most striking was Market Basket's Plaza out in Epping. It has a different name. I think it's called Brickyard Plaza, but everybody calls it Market Basket Plaza. Excuse me. There's a 900 Degrees pizza restaurant there and Popovers out of Portsmouth. Those are both independent businesses that put all their second eggs in this basket. This is their second location for these two companies. So, and the 900 Degrees pizza place, which is based out of Manchester, it's an even bigger location than their original. There's a movie theater there. There's a tortilla flats restaurant, a whole bunch of different shops, And those stores are reporting they're getting, you know, their numbers are down. And they're getting people walking over who used to work at Market Basket applying for jobs there.
Wow. Again, the number for you to join us here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Join us with your questions and comments as we take another quick look at the Market Basket situation, whether there may be a breakthrough in this ongoing saga or not. The number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Kurt, here's another question. The narrative of this story, which we've heard now for weeks, you know, RDT good, Arthur S. bad. I went to a local Market Basket yesterday knowing that I was going to be talking to you guys today. Definitely that was the theme there. There were pictures up of RDT with all these lovely quotes of, you know, being in the people business first and the grocery business second. There were pictures and quotes up of the so-called bad cousin, RDS. And, you know, his big quote was, the company is all about the shareholders, and just all sorts of stuff like that all over the store. What about this narrative? Is it that simple? One guy's good, the other guy's bad.
I don't think it is. I think it's a complex story, and it's a great way that it's been boiled down to that point. Of course, you know, anybody who's covered these folks or been around in New England for a while knows that, you know, this feud between the two sides of the family has been long, and a jury convicted Arthur T. Demoulas of doing, you know, not good, more the bad stuff, essentially cheating the other side of the family out of some of its shares. So there's a long history, and I think one reason the good versus evil took place is because it may very well reflect the truth, but I think it also reflects who's been speaking and who hasn't been. And so just the fact that you have workers and working class folks out there asking for the good guy to come back, that's been a really strong narrative. But I think it is evolving a little bit for some people in the public sphere, because as this ripples out, as you see impacts on more people, as you see part-time workers who have to stay home, as you see parents who see their kids who are making money for college in the fall not have anything to do anymore, and as you see a lot of low-income people who rely on Market Basket have to spend a lot more money and travel around to different places to get food. It's just, the consequences of the choice are becoming more and more apparent. And so I think it's reflecting a little bit more the complex nature of the conflict.
Yeah, as it goes on and on. Mike, did anybody think it would go on this long? How long has it been? Like 4 weeks, 3 weeks?
It just seems forever, and I don't think anybody saw this coming, because there's nothing to – what do you measure this to? This has never happened before, and the national media has picked up this story here and there. But because Market Basket only operates primarily in New Hampshire and Massachusetts, it hasn't gotten the oomph that it would have otherwise. I mean, this is a populist story, and although it's much more complicated than we see, because we're not involved in these day-to-day – you know, battles between these two cousins, it's become this populist story. I mean, Arthur T. has been compared to George Bailey and Santa Claus, and one of the protesters had him. You know, he's our Greek god. You know, he's been created, and all Arthur T. has to do is just say nothing. You know, we keep seeing this image. You know, the one that keeps being shown on TV over and over again is the one where he's in the back seat of the car and he's waving. You know, and it's presidential.
All right, let's go to our callers. Again, 1-800-892-6477. To Kristen first in Concord. Hi, Kristen. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Two quick questions. One, has RDT called for people to come back to work? And second of all, my son has been working at Market Basket since he was 15. He's 19 now, and he's a part-timer, so he's been, quote-unquote, laid off. How is he supposed to go back to work when they're not giving him any hours?
Wow. So if I could ask you a question, Kristen, what is he thinking and feeling about this whole situation? What does he want to do?
Well, he loved his job. He just got transferred to the Hooks at One, where he was working, help making food, and he loves it. He's always loved working at Market Basket. But the fact is, he's potentially now got a new full-time job. So, I mean, he's moved on because he needs income. But he would probably like to go back to Market Basket as well. So he's been a torn.
He's gotten another job? Is that what you're saying?
I hope so. He had a working interview yesterday, so hopefully he got a new job.
Wow. All right. And last question for you, Kristen, because, again, you're more involved in this than we are. This threat from the board saying, you know, come back to work on by Friday or not, or lose your job. What's your son going to do?
I would like to talk to him about that today. I don't think he's going to go back. I think he really supports RDT. I think for a 19-year-old, he has a pretty good understanding of some of the dynamics that have happened, and this is kind of a win-all or lose-all in terms of workers' rights.
Okay. Kristen, thanks a lot for calling in. What do you think, Mike Cody, the risk that, you know, they're going to start losing some folks? They won't go back to work at MicroBasket. They'll just find jobs elsewhere.
Well, there's certainly that risk. I mean, people are, particularly people who are working their part-time, kids working their way through school, parents who work their part-time, they'll have to find something else. But I keep thinking more about the shoppers, because even if Market Basket reopens today and even over the next few weeks, they replenish their shelves, bring all the meat back, perishables, people change their habits over time. And it's getting to the point where folks who are going to Stop and Shop or Hannaford or wherever are starting to get used to going to the same place every day. People go to stores not just for price, but because they know where everything is. You go to the same store every week, you know where everything is. And Hannaford, I'm sure, is working hard. How are we going to keep these people once Market Basket comes back? You know, they keep 10% of them, 20% of them. That's a gold mine.
Sure. And boy, it's annoying when they change where things are. It takes you twice as long to get through the store. But talking about, you know, scooping up other workers and, as Mike points out, Kurt Nickisch, other customers. Someone who helps out on the show told us that he lives in Nashua. He said he went to the Nashua Hannafords and that the cashier was lovely, very friendly, said he was all the way from the Rockland, Maine Hannaford store, that the company was putting them up at hotels, giving them 50, 60 hours a week. Rockland, Maine is like 3 or 4 hours from Nashua. So here's Hannaford's, Kurt, really trying to give people a great experience.
Yeah, I think that's right, and I think they've a lot of supermarkets have seen this as an opportunity, because you essentially have a lot of people coming through who wouldn't normally come to your place, and it's their chance to sort of show what they offer and their experience, and some of those customers may well stick. I think the big question is how many, because you know, we still like to go to the one that's close, we still like to go to the one that's cheaper. And so a lot of people will return to Market Basket, but it's going to take a hit. And I guess the question is how much and how long that damage is sustained.
Yeah.
So the longer it goes on, maybe the you know, the more damage it does. You know, you do hear from more and more people saying, "Get this has got to, you know, be over, because I need to go back to shopping and I'm tired of spending more money at other places." So,
well, yeah, Kristen, thanks for the call and good luck to your son in whatever choice he makes. Mike, did you want to jump back in?
Yeah, I want to read from a letter that in our letters to the editor page today from a reader who this is the kind of emotion and thought that's coming out now. We talked about Arthur T. and maybe we're starting to see some cracks in the image. "I am totally dismayed with the volatile situation at Market Basket, and I am wondering why Arthur T. has not come forward to tell the workers how much he appreciates their loyalty, but that the best thing for them is to return to work immediately. The threat of layoffs is imminent, and I'm sure some of the workers are now second-guessing their actions. It won't be Arthur T. who won't be able to pay his bills, since he is a very wealthy man. It will be the employees who don't have the unlimited budget he enjoys who will be severely hurting. In my mind, he is doing his followers a great disservice by not coming forward."
So some people getting frustrated with how long this has gone on and the impact on people like our caller's son. Let's go to another caller. This is Catherine in Conway. Hi, Catherine. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Thank you. Yes, I just wanted to say that I feel that the workers are being villainized because since Governor Patrick made his statement, his wife works for the law firm that represents Arthur S. And a lot of people don't know that. And for the workers to go back and build that company puts the power back in Arthur S.'s hands until the deal is signed between Arthur T. and Arthur S.
So Deval Patrick saying, Kurt Nickisch, that he's not taking sides, but Catherine, our caller, kind of feels like he is. Have you heard other people say that as well?
Yeah, I've heard other people say that. I should we should qualify this to some extent, and I did report on this. The governor has had, you know, constituents reach out to him and say, why aren't you getting involved with Market Basket like you did with the Hyatt hotel workers here in Boston? And, you know, and is this because of, is it political or is it because of a conflict of interest with your wife, and he basically said that, you know, he felt like the Hyatt Hotel situation here had to do with mistreatment of workers, and this is more about the choice of a CEO and not necessarily mistreatment of workers. So that's why he didn't feel it was appropriate for him to step in for that. And he also explained that he didn't know that his wife's law firm does work for Market Basket's board. It's incorrect, apparently, to say that that the firm Ropes and Gray represents Market Basket, but they do work for the board, including hosting some of their meetings. He said that you know, who his wife's clients are, and of course Ropes and Gray is a big Boston law firm with many, many clients. He says it just doesn't affect his decisions. But it's a fair point to bring up, but also to qualify.
Well, Patrick did say yesterday, he said, I think it's important for the workers to understand, for associates to understand, that they can go right back to work and that they would do a service to the people served by Market Basket. And here's the other part that jumped out to me. He said, usually companies are able to buy and sell each other without workers walking off the job and saying they're not going to work unless they get the boss of their choice. So kind of sounds, Kurt, like he is taking sides there a little bit.
Yeah, if you listen to what he said, and we did post his full comments up on our website at WBUR.org, he also criticized the board, and he sort of said that the board needs to step up and start serving people and thinking about all of its shareholders. So some of the criticism went all the way around, and he also sounded relatively, he didn't sound definite. He said things like he thinks it would be good if workers could see a way to get back to work to stabilize the company. And he said he wants economic peace at the company.
Economic peace. That's probably something everybody's looking for. Kurt, I got to cut you off there. I do apologize.
Sure thing.
Thank you very much. I think we'll be talking to you again about this issue. Thank you.
Of course.
That's Kurt Nikisch, WBUR's business and technology reporter who's been covering the Market Basket story. Mike Cody, it's very nice of you to come in. Good to see you, and thank you as well.
Thank you, Laura.
Mike Cody, business and city editor at the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. An alarming spike in overdoses from the synthetic drug Spice gets police attention in Manchester. Fairpoint workers picket across the region ahead of the next round of contract negotiations. And 400 years after Captain John Smith's expedition to New England, a monument in his honor is erected in Rye. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and from Courier Museum of Art in Manchester, presenting Romare Bearden, A Black Odyssey, an alternative take on Homer from this talented African-American artist, Courier.org. And from The Telegraph, providing local news coverage and advertising opportunities for today's complexities, online at NashuaTelegraph.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. The U.S. auto market is booming. After a dip following the Great Recession, New car sales are on track to see their best year since 2006. But Americans' long-term romance with cars may be waning. Teens are getting their driver's licenses later and waiting longer to purchase a first car. Many millennials either cannot afford a car or do not want to own one. New technology means car sharing and mass transit are easier and more reliable, and more cities are making it harder to park. Some new buildings are being designed with no parking spaces at all. Americans' changing relationship with driving. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Police in Ferguson, Missouri have used tear gas, smoke bombs, and stun grenades to break up a demonstration last night in the St. Louis suburb. There have been constant protests since last weekend's fatal police shooting of an unarmed black teenager. A protest on Sunday night was violent, and police have turned out in force since then. At one protest last night, police gave instructions to marchers.
Please continue down Canfield or West Florissant. Please continue moving peacefully, as you have been.
In another incident, protesters threw Molotov cocktails and other objects at police officers who were in protective gear and using armored trucks. Starting next week, same-sex couples in Virginia might be allowed to legally marry. That's if the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't step in. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports a federal appeals court is refusing to delay its ruling against the state's ban on gay marriage.
The decision means Virginia will also have to recognize same-sex marriages performed in other states. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling will also impact West Virginia and North and South Carolina. But supporters of the ban have appealed to the Supreme Court, which could order a stay of the decision even after couples start to marry. That's happened in other states, where hundreds of newlyweds are now in legal limbo. Since